The matter of State versus Quinizel Clark. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Daniel Rockoff, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Clark.
Welcome, counsel. Please be seated. We have today the continuation of the argument. Please focus your presentations on the Fifth Amendment issue that the clerk's order directed us to focus on. And the court has a motion to strike an email exchange between trial counsel that was appended to the state's supplemental respondent's brief. The motion is denied. Mr. Rockoff.
Your Honors, I would just begin by requesting 2 minutes of rebuttal time, should it be necessary. Thank you. So it violated Clark's Fifth Amendment privilege and New Jersey common law privilege for the trial court to allow the prosecutor to present as evidence of guilt that the defendant asked for a lawyer when an interrogating officer accusing him of murder pressed him to exculpate himself. In order to prevent the wrongful conviction of an innocent man, the appellate division's order for a new trial must be affirmed. I'll be highlighting 4 points today. First, I'll address what Miranda recognized, that Fifth Amendment invocations of the right to counsel are not admissible evidence at a criminal trial. Defendants like Clark face a penalty when Fifth Amendment invocations are improperly admitted as evidence, especially if a defendant invoked the Fifth in the face of an accusation. Second, I'll address why the harm at Clark's trial was so egregious and capable of causing an unjust result. In short, the improperly admitted evidence was used against Clark at every turn, from start to finish. The video evidence presented by the prosecutor was more than a secondhand report of a bare invocation. To cause an unjust result, all the prosecutor had to do was press play. It showed Clark invoking as the interrogator insinuated that Clark was a liar and a murderer, that invoking his rights wasn't what the interrogator would be doing if he were in Clark's seat, that Clark's attempts to remain silent without his lawyer were illegitimate, and that his claiming of the Fifth Amendment privilege showed the protestations of innocence were, quote, bullshit. The prosecutor then improperly used the state's direct examination and summation to focus jurors' attention on why Clark wouldn't clear his own name. Third point to highlight, the trial court failed to tell jurors not to use the Fifth Amendment invocations as evidence of guilt. Even when the jury rewatched Clark's invocations of his right to counsel all over again in summation, the court still gave no curative instruction. I'd add in a case like this that no instruction could have cured the harm. Fourth, the state found no direct evidence of guilt, so in light of the weak proofs that Clark had anything to do with this offense, no error was harmless. Taking a step back from Clark's case, I would underscore it's imperative that people who are in the coercive environment of a custodial interrogation, who are accused of crimes, and who are Mirandized, should feel free to embrace the constitutional right to the aid of a lawyer. People must not fear that a request for a lawyer in the face of accusation will be used against them at trial to secure a wrongful conviction. For the trial court to let the state use as evidence of guilt without any limiting instruction that my client asked for the aid of a lawyer rather than to try to persuade officers of his innocence in the face of accusation, unfairly penalized Clark for embracing his constitutional rights, was clearly capable of causing an unjust result and requires a new trial. So that does conclude my opening statement. I would now go on to first that the invocations of the right to counsel were not admissible evidence. The trial court had an independent gatekeeping responsibility to shut these constitutional invocations out and to guard against impermissible inferences. This prohibition, it goes back to Miranda. Quote, the prosecution may not use at trial the fact that an individual stood mute or claimed his privilege in the face of accusation. Making evidentiary use of the exercise of the constitutional rights breached the government's promise, was fundamentally unfair, was barred by the Due Process Clause. To wit, the government promised Clark that he had the right to a lawyer and the right to stop talking at any time. As SCOTUS explained in Wainwright, the reading of these Miranda rights conveyed the government's assurances. Clark relied on the government's promise. When interrogators accused Clark of murder and pressed him to exculpate himself, he was induced to claim his rights. The reason for the prohibition in Miranda is that admission of a Fifth Amendment invocation is a penalty. No matter the rights protected by the Constitution, quote, silence in the face of accusation, this is from Miranda, is itself damning and will bode ill when presented to a jury. So I'd like to address the harm. So this is my second main point. The harm from the Fifth Amendment invocation evidence was capable of causing an unjust result at Clark's trial. This wasn't just a bare, fleeting recordation of the defendant saying, call my lawyer. The state presented video evidence that Clark asked for a lawyer three times in response to accusations in the midst of insinuations that the invocations were not consistent with innocence. So his first request to call my lawyer was in response to being pressed for proof of alibi, things like tell us exactly where you were, I'll have it run down in an hour, we got 50 guys out there. It was also in response to the interrogator's accusation that Clark was a murderer who was lying about his alibi, things like it's game over, it wasn't true, you weren't with anybody who was going to say, oh yeah, Q was with me. So he asked to call my attorney. Then his second request to go get my attorney just a few minutes later was a response to, again, being pressed for proof of alibi, do you want us to run that down, et cetera, was in response to the interrogator opining that asking for a lawyer was not what he, an innocent person, would do if he were in Clark's seat. So, quote, if I was sitting in your seat, somebody was telling me that I'm good for murdering the guy, I would say, you know what, I was with this person. You can go check him. I'm not on the hook for that. If I was on the hook for something like that, I would probably say who I was with. Let us run it down. And it was given in response, the second invocation was given in response to the interrogator opining, quote, that showed he was lying, quote, you have absolutely no desire to tell us who you were with because it's bullshit. Same thing, third request to go get my attorney was in response to, again, being pressed for proof of alibi. So all this evidence cast the invocations in a suspicious light. Without the prosecutor needing to say a word, it's kind of like what happened in Tung. The interrogator made comments to the defendant that an innocent man would not be asking for a lawyer. The interrogator plainly suggested during the interrogation that he could not understand why the defendant would want to consult a lawyer. The magnitude of the harm here, I would say, was greater because of the multimedia nature of this coming from the defendant's own lips. So not only is it not, it's specific and not generalized, it's no longer secondhand, it's firsthand. There's a video recording, there's an audio recording, there's a transcription of Clark invoking his rights in the face of accusation, request for exculpatory proof. So that's more harmful than what we've seen in the past. Like in the 90s, the 90s set of cases, Oglesby 1991, High 1996, Moore 97, Feaster 98, Oliveira and Togman 2001. The prosecutor is just eliciting testimony.
It's not just a statement too, it's the exploitation of it.
Yes.
I'm looking at page 177, right after the statement is read to the jury. If there was any doubt in the jury's mind, the first question sort of resolved it. Detective, during the course of that statement, did Mr. Clark tell you who he was with that day? No, sir.
That's correct. So the prosecutor used direct examination as well, and after the video was played and the harm from the video, to comment or to use an improper trial tactic to comment on Clark's silence. So it's the sequence of the presentation, I think, that makes it so damning. Making reference at trial to what a defendant didn't say to the police is commenting on his silence. It's impermissible for a prosecutor to imply, as the quotes you just gave do, that an innocent man would not have stopped speaking to the police, that defendant's guilt can be inferred from his silence. And this continued in summations. The prosecutor similarly used summation to comment on the defendant's invocations. So the prosecutor called jurors' attention to Clark's response when the interrogator practically begged him to give up proof of alibi so that law enforcement could track it down. You know, that's an unmistakable reference to the moments Clark asked for a lawyer upon being entreated five times in a row by the interrogator to let officers run it down, run that down, run that down, run it down, run that down. Again, practically begged him so that law enforcement could track him down. It's a reference back to the exchange where Clark's invoking, which is like Togman. So another prosecutor used summation to call attention to the defendant asking for a lawyer, claiming his right to remain silent in response to being pressed, begged here by the interrogator to let officers run down proof of alibi. Again, sort of the same breath in summation, the prosecutor is calling attention to Clark's post-Miranda silence. The quote is like, so Clark won't give up this person who he's doing business with, an alibi witness, quote, still won't, even after he's read his Miranda rights. So, you know, I would quote like Doyle, it violates due process for a prosecutor to call attention to post-Miranda silence. The comment here implies that an innocent person's response to being Mirandized would be to talk, to prove innocence, but embracing the Miranda rights, after the Miranda rights have been read to you, like, somehow that's suspicious. Same breath, the prosecutor's directing jurors, to focus deliberations on why a defendant would embrace his rights.
Also, trigger Diatar and Doyle, both of which stand for the proposition that when you invoke your silence, it also represents the fact that the defendant is not required to give his exculpatory story to the police. That's the very purpose of giving the person the right to remain silent, either by invoking the right to counsel or just saying, I don't want to talk.
So that goes to the prosecutor saying, you know, ask yourself why. Why is Clark remaining silent? Why isn't he clearing his own name? Why isn't he giving up proof of alibi? You know, I would look back to Tong. So part of the cumulative prejudice in Tong it wasn't just the admission of these statements. It was officers saying things like, well, why? Like, what's the reason? Like, why are you remaining silent? Here, the prosecutor actually raises the same question, ask yourself why, in summation. Why isn't
But in Clark- this case, he had actually mentioned being in a place and with a person as an alibi.
It's really clear from summation that the prosecutor can't be referring really to anything that precedes like the invocation exchange. So if you look back like earlier in the statement to when they're discussing like his route throughout the day, like the interrogator doesn't press him directly, doesn't beg him about who he was. About who he was with, doesn't even directly ask him who he was with, doesn't offer to have law enforcement track the person down. None of that happens until right before the first invocation. So when the prosecutor's saying, ask yourself why, like even when he was practically begged to have law enforcement track it down, it really can't be referring to anything that precedes the invocation exchange.
But just to be clear, there's a distinction, isn't there, between a situation where in a vacuum the state takes the position that he was with the officers all day talking about this and he never provided an alibi. He never said what he was doing versus this individual actually offered a vague alibi in this case. He actually brought up that he was with somebody.
Right. So, absent the invocations, the prosecutor can certainly comment on vagueness. Can never comment on a defendant's silence, but can certainly comment on vagueness.
But I think could comment on him bringing up that he was with somebody in a particular place, and then would not identify provide any particulars on that.
But I think given the way the statement was played, the interrogator's insinuations, the direct examination, the fact that there was a question about his silence immediately after the invocations were played, and then in summation, it's so clear that these comments are referring directly back to the invocation exchange. Regardless of what other arguments the prosecutor could have made, it's so clear that the prosecutor's use of these invocations from start to finish was a direct attack on my client's Fifth Amendment right to counsel. So I would move on to my third point. So there was no limiting instruction.
But before you get there, your first two points, your argument is that this was error and that it was egregious. Was the transcript that the jury heard a version that both counsel agreed to in advance?
I would say, like, at minimum, we have to recognize that that the defense counsel, her initial position was that all statements to law enforcement should be suppressed. So even though there was a motion to suppress made, even though there was a motion to suppress that was made on different grounds, it's clear that defense counsel wasn't playing 11th dimensional chess, that she asked the court to suppress all statements post the Miranda waiver. To the extent that the prosecutor is presenting not just the video but the transcript to the jury, defense counsel has already made known her position that none of the defendant's statements should be presented to the jury.
So there's an exchange, the email exchange between prosecutor and defense attorney, who was not you, and the defense attorney is asked tell me what's clearly inadmissible and should be redacted. And counsel then identifies a proposed list of redactions, but doesn't have any problem with this coming before the jury. Is that?
Well, so first of all, I would say, like I just said, one, it's obvious. So her initial position from the record, we know what she said to the trial court, was that these statements should be suppressed. And then, but even in these emails,
just for time purposes, that motion was presented, that motion was ruled upon, and then we get into what is it that the jury is going to hear in light of the court's ruling.
Right.
Does counsel request that these passages that you have referred to toward the end of the statement be redacted?
So first of all, it's I think it's not really clear from the emails what those page numbers are even referring to. So the page numbers in the attachment, I would point out, do not actually match up with the copies of the statements that we have. I mean, the page numbers are different. Like, they go beyond the maximum number of pages in the final statement.
Isn't that clarified by the response of the email that follows?
No, I think it's common for different copies of statements to float around with different page numbers. Those emails from the prosecutor don't clarify.
Well, let me ask you this then. Are you telling us that defense counsel did ask for this to be redacted, but that there was a mistake somehow made?
I'm saying that those emails just don't clarify either way, which takes us back to the record, which is what defense counsel asked on the record for suppression of statements to law enforcement. And I would say at a minimum, this isn't...
Let's stay with this area because I'm struggling to understand what happened here. It certainly appears as though defense counsel proposed specific redactions on the subject of jail, bail, or drug dealing. Did not, it appears from looking at the exchange, ask to have the language about invocation of counsel be redacted. Then there's some back and forth about which pages apply and another listing of the pages that seems to allow the critical language on pages 49, 50, and 51 to come in. And counsel says, thank you, defense counsel, thank you for accommodating. I have no objection.
Well,
and so on.
One thing that I would say, even what you just read to me, defense counsel never actually asks for any statements to come in. So at minimum, this isn't invited error. It's like the definition of invited error is like a very specific definition when a party beseeches and requests the trial court to take a certain course of action. Defense counsel never, even in those emails, never asks for any statements to come in. I mean, she's at worst trying to make lemonade out of lemons after her motion has been denied. But this is entirely being driven by the prosecutor. The prosecutor alone at trial, it's clear, is the sole party to have introduced Clark's statement.
Didn't she, in her cross-examination of Detective Rayner, specifically refer to the things that we're talking about? Did you charge him that day? Defendant said to you a number of times, charge me with this, call my lawyer. That's defense counsel saying that at trial, in cross-examination of Detective Rayner, and then she argues that very point, that clearly he's innocent. He never confessed, notwithstanding all this stuff, and all these times he was badgered, and all these times he refused to incriminate himself. Actually use that at trial?
But I would respond in a few ways. First of all, I think, again, it's just her making lemons out of lemonade after, the bell has been rung. Some bells can't be unrung.
Is that argument ever made at trial at any point? Is there any indication she didn't know exactly what she was doing and using his statements and the way he gave them as evidence that he's innocent because he never confessed?
Well, the ultimate question here is the effect on the jury and not what defense counsel is thinking. But even so,
raised the invited error question.
Well, at minimum, it's not, like I was saying, it's not an invited error because defense counsel was not beseeching anyone for these statements to come in. It's just the prosecutor who was moving for these statements to come in. I would point out defendants.
Beseeching the jury to consider the facts that you are now saying were error in acquitting him.
First of all, her reference to the line from defendant was, I think, in part I would say, could be perceived as incidental. I mean, she's making a point independent of the invocation itself, which is that police didn't charge the defendant. So, like, the invocations.
No, but at the end of the video, defendant said to you a number of times, charge me with this, call my lawyer. Did you charge him that day? She said that.
Right, but like I think the question that she's focusing on in cross-examination is the fact that the police didn't charge the defendant that day, which is a point independent, going to lack of probable cause of the invocations themselves. Like, moreover, I would make the point that, like, again, this is being entirely driven by the prosecutor. So I go back to those emails. The prosecutor in those emails is saying, let's let both statements come in, the statement from January 2016 and the statement from July 2016. What happened at trial? The prosecutor did not introduce the July 2016 statement. Did defense counsel, like, seek to then elicit that statement independently? No. Like, this is... The fact of the elicitations themselves, what defense counsel said to police, her defense counsel's position below was very clearly, as per the motion to suppress, that these statements should not come in.
Can you tell us, if you're right, that this was error and that it should have never come before the jury, it should be analyzed on direct appeal or as part of a PCR?
It should be analyzed under direct appeal, and that's it's a plain error standard. It's reversible under the plain error standard. The ultimate issue here is the effect on the jury, whether the admission of constitutional invocations harmed the defendant's right for a fair trial. So just like, for example, like anything that could be coming in that's harmful to the defendant, references to a warrant. So this isn't a case where, like, the invocations coming in, the effect on the jury is really bad. That's something that can be dealt with on direct appeal. Like, the issue here, again, is not what defense counsel was thinking. The issue isn't whether, like, the interrogation could continue under the under, like, any particular standard. This is something that, like, considering the effect on the jury of these constitutional invocations having come in is something that is firmly within the realm of direct appeal.
Do we know from the record that we have whether there might have been some strategy here, or was it a simple error in your judgment?
I think it's an error. It's what defense counsel was thinking is not the ultimate question here. It's the enormously prejudicial effect on the jury. You know, I would go to, like, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which I said in my brief. The nature of a Doyle-Wainwright error is so egregious that reversal is the norm, not the exception.
What counsel was thinking would be relevant if this were analyzed under the framework for ineffective assistance. We don't have that. We just have the exchange of emails that ends with, I have no objection. Thanks for accommodating.
I mean, I would just return to, you know, what I've been saying, which is that, like, we know what counsel was thinking on the record, which is none of these statements should come in. After that motion is denied, she's trying to make, you know, lemonade out of lemons.
But nothing stopped her. Nothing stopped her from saying, in addition to jail, bail, the drug issues that were her focus, I want the following removed because it is related to the invocation, et cetera, the argument that you're now making. So yes, you can say she lost her motion, so she had to develop a strategy, but how can we tell, based on this direct appeal record with no testimony or certification from counsel,
I would say that
this was not strategic, especially given the fact that she affirmatively used some of this?
So I'd point you to even cases. So I think Hyde is in the appellate division a long time ago. They even recognized in that case that even in a case where there is some indication of defense strategy, quote, impingement upon defendant's constitutional right to remain silent qualifies, in our view, as an error of sufficient magnitude to overcome the usual rule of charging defendant with the consequences of attorney strategy. And again, I would say that it isn't even really the case here. Defense counsel doesn't want these statements to come in. She asked for them to be excluded. Once they're excluded, she doesn't ever ask the prosecutor or the court for any statements to come in.
If you make a motion to suppress the entire statement and then it's denied, and yet there's a process going on here because there are other issues other than the arguments that were made on the motion to suppress. There were other arguments to exclude part of it. So there's a process going on, and I suspect happens quite a bit, where additional redactions are being made either by the state or at the request of the defendant or by stipulation, which is separate from the original motion to suppress that was denied. It doesn't mean I lost my whole motion, therefore I've lost the battle here.
Right.
There's an additional process to exclude portions of the statement.
Right. I mean,
and well, we see that going on in the emails.
Right. But in the emails, I'll just point out, I don't think we really know what the page numbers refer to. But that being said, we do know that defense counsel never asked for any of these statements to come in. So, like, the definition of invited error just doesn't really apply here in terms of, like, seeing any indication that trial counsel asked for.
The question is whether there could have been a reasonable strategy involved, you know, especially when you look at the overall facts of this case, in having some of this information available to the jury to argue the very points that Justice Solomon referred to that actually were argued in this case.
You know, I mean, I would just go back to Miranda. Like, the courts, the black letter law, the courts have recognized for 50 years that the effect of a constitutional invocation coming in penalizes the defendant egregiously. Breaking it down. It's, you know, if you're innocent, like, why are you invoking the Fifth? I mean, it's the sort of judgment that is widely accepted and widely recognized to be how people would react to.
One part of your answer is puzzling to me. I think we know precisely what lines were requested and not. If you simply compare the emails to DA 77, 78, 79, the pages match up, the words that were removed match up, and this was left. So the question I'll leave with you is this. Can you explain to us why there was no request on the defense's part to redact this critical language?
We don't know what defense counsel was thinking, to answer your question, but I would go back to my points, which is she asked for this to be redacted. Once that motion was denied, she never asked or never beseeched the court or the prosecutor to admit any of these statements. When the prosecutor chose not to include in his trial presentation some of these statements that he indicated in these emails that he was going to present at trial, defense counsel didn't pick that up and choose any of them independently herself. These are admissions that are at trial entirely being driven by the prosecutor.
I guess the dividing line here is between plain error and invited error, which suggests strategy. And I take it your position is that, like, what strategy could there be? She moved to suppress the entire statement and then permitted in the most damning piece of evidence, which permitted the prosecutor to say, like, why would the defendant not tell you who he was with at Roebling? Like, why wouldn't he do that? And he hasn't produced that person. Like, what could, there couldn't be anything more damning than that. Could
Correct. I don't know what was going on in Jennifer Gottschalk's, the defense attorney's head, but it doesn't matter. Sorry?
What's going on in her head? She does it when she's cross-examining Detective Rayner, and she tells you in her closing, this guy's clearly innocent because he's badgered, he's pressed repeatedly, and he never confesses. He never gives it up.
So if defense counsel wanted these statements in, she could have admitted the entire 70-plus pages from.
She have to ask for anything. We know exactly what she's thinking, and she demonstrates it in her cross-examination of the detective and in her closing, that she wants the jury to believe that.
But she only makes resort to these statements after the prosecutor has already elicited them. You know, the trial court, I think at one point, describes, like,
It explains the emails. You're talking about strategy. It certainly explains the emails, why she didn't object to this, because her whole argument's going to be, he would have confessed. What guy stands up under all this pressure and still doesn't confess?
I think the emails, the primary takeaway from them is that, you know, the motion to suppress has been denied. She's still not beseeching the prosecutor to let any statements in. When the prosecutor decides,
I understand that.
The 70-plus pages from July that the court describes as being 70-plus pages of denial, that Jennifer Gottschalk, is the defense attorney, is not presenting these, is not presenting these statements in evidence herself.
If the strategy is, look, my client was examined for however long it was, an hour, 2 hours, and never confessed, she wouldn't have been making a motion to suppress the entire statement, would she? I don't think so. No? And the other thing, I'm thinking in terms of invited error, typically at least. I'm not saying that this is a general rule that would apply to all circumstances, is that the defendant affirmatively introduces something, like hearsay, to gain some sort of advantage, and then can't be heard to complain when the prosecutor winds up introducing something else. Whereas here, not only the statement was played, but on direct examination, the prosecutor hammered home the fact that the defendant didn't name the person who he was with in Roebling, and then was responding in result to that.
That's correct. I mean, this is entirely being driven by the prosecutor from start to finish. You've got video evidence being elicited by being presented by the prosecutor, has a great magnitude of harm. It's a multimedia presentation from the defendant's own lips. Again, using direct examination to comment on the defendant's silence. The fact that immediately after the jury hears that he invoked in response in the face of accusation, the prosecutor confirms with the witness that he didn't tell you who he was with. Similarly, using summation to comment on the video that the prosecutor and the prosecutor alone played, that the interrogator practically begged him to give up proof of alibi so that law enforcement could track it down, all coming from the prosecutor. So to the extent that the question is, who elicited this evidence, who presented this evidence, it's from the state, and the defendant is only reacting to it. I'd like to address, this type of evidence, for whatever reason, that admission was not on its own clearly capable of causing an unjust result. The fact that the trial court abdicated its responsibility to give a limiting instruction, I think, is gravely prejudicial. So there's no limiting instruction here, even under Feaster, where the evidence was permitted to come in to show an ending, which again is not applicable here. The trial court has an independent gatekeeping responsibility to give a limiting instruction, and none was given here, even when the jury rewatched the defendant's invocation all over again in deliberations. So the trial court had a duty under Feaster to provide a cautionary instruction, emphasizing that the invocation of his right to counsel may not in any way be used to infer guilt, was not given here. By not giving any limiting instruction, while the court failed to guard against the impermissible inferences from the prosecutor's evidence and arguments. So then in deliberations, the jury again asked to rewatch the interrogation. Again, the invocations were not fleeting or isolated. As in Tongue, the jury heard these exchanges twice, both during trial and then again during deliberations. And again, the court provided no limiting instruction. So as in Moore, as in Tongue, the failure to instruct, I would say, is dispositive here. And I would quote Moore. They say that their view of the case hinged on an immediate and effective limiting instruction not being given. So, I would emphasize here, I don't think an instruction here could have cured the error. Some bells can't be unrung. But in any case, the trial court abdicated its just did not give the limiting instruction as required. Fourth, I would...
Did the judge know that counsel had agreed to that portion that was to be redacted and to be played?
I would say that I don't think that it doesn't look like there is an agreement in place. I mean, what's going on in those emails? I hate to keep coming back to them, but there's no...
Go ahead, finish your answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that there's no indication in those emails that defense counsel was saying, I want these statements to come in, being driven entirely by the prosecutor, even if the court...
I understand your position.
Okay.
Assume that one might interpret this back and forth as counsel have settled on what should and should not come in. Was the judge made aware that counsel had worked through this?
The record doesn't show the defense counsel after the suppression motion has been entered on the record, disputing the transcript as presented to the jury. So, but at that point, the trial court still has a gatekeeping responsibility, even if the parties have settled their differences, in order to prevent an unjust result, to make sure that.
I understand. I'm looking for your help on a different question.
Okay.
I'm not going to stop you from making that. You've made that argument with full-throated passion. Was there, from the record, any conversation with the court about whether counsel had settled on what should come before the jury?
No, Your Honors, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
But he must have known. There was a motion to suppress the entire statement. Was that before the redactions or after the redactions?
That was before the redactions.
Okay, so the judge would have known the before and the after, and therefore we can infer that he must have known that there was some agreement to the redactions, no?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
So on the first motion to suppress the entire thing, the entire statement, the judge had a statement where three times the defendant invoked his right to counsel, and the colloquy continued. I take it it's your position that he had independent obligation to raise whether or not that further colloquy should come in? Go ahead.
Yeah, the trial court, and it's not just my position. It's what the court has said in Feaster, that the court has an obligation to ensure that these statements, as per Miranda, as per Wainwright, as per Doyle, do not come in. And if they come in order to show an ending, which this wasn't about showing an ending, the trial court has a mandatory duty to provide a limiting instruction that the Fifth Amendment invocations cannot be used as evidence of guilt, which is essential because the statements are being admitted as evidence, and absent that type of instruction, the potential for an unjust result from the jury using the statements where the defendant is invoking his Fifth Amendment right and seeking the protection of the Constitution can be used as evidence of guilt. So absolutely, there's a mandatory duty to provide a limiting instruction here. This is plain error. It's reversible under the plain error standard, regardless of admissibility. And it's essential that an instruction be given. And I would emphasize again, I don't think any instruction could have cured the error here.
I don't know what a limiting instruction could do. But had the judge at the time of the motion suppressed asked the simple question, which would have been obvious when you're looking at a transcript and the defendant is repeatedly saying, I want my attorney, and the colloquy continues, that under those circumstances, the judge would have an independent obligation to at least say, can anything come in after that?
Correct. Yes? The court had an independent obligation to bar this evidence from coming in front of the jury, had an independent gatekeeping obligation to make sure the jury was properly instructed. None of that was done. Even had that been done, I think there's a decent argument that it would still have been capable of causing an unjust result, that no instruction could have cured the error here.
Was the tape played at the suppression hearing? Was the transcript reviewed in its entirety with the court at the suppression hearing?
I can't recall if at the suppression hearing the statement was played, but it was certainly presented as I believe it was presented as evidence to the court.
Was this the debate about the last several pages focused on specifically at the suppression hearing?
The suppression hearing was focused on everything after, which would encompass those statements, but not be specific to them. It was focused on everything after the waiver being given, essentially whether any of the defendant's statements could come in.
Right. So was there a specific focus on pages 49, 50, and 51 of the document I'm looking at, DA 77 and forward?
No, there wasn't a specific focus. But again, it would be my position that because the defendant is asking as a remedy for the entire statement to be suppressed, that's part of defense counsel's at least preliminary position.
It isn't your strongest argument. The judge should have stepped in once he heard this at trial.
Yes. Yes.
You're not holding the judge responsible for parts of a very lengthy statement that counsel have not highlighted, or are you?
I would agree with you that at minimum, once the court heard this at trial, the trial court had an absolute duty to provide a limiting instruction here, and that wasn't given. So fourth, I would just highlight that in the absence, that the error here was not harmless in light of the circumstances of this case, essentially the total absence of direct evidence. So there's no direct proof that Clark had any contact with the decedent, no direct proof for 3 hours before the decedent was shot doing heroin. No eyewitnesses saw the shooting period. No eyewitnesses testified. He was at the crime scene directly. The eyewitnesses were not familiar with whomever they saw. At least one of the eyewitnesses has expressed the opinion that the perpetrator was definitely not black. There was no testimony in evidence about whether or not investigators asked eyewitnesses for views on Clark. There's no video of Clark at the crime scene. There's no confession. The perpetrator was not apprehended, fleeing the scene, leaving no doubt as to identity. There's no murder weapon, not even direct proof that Clark's ever touched a weapon in his life. No direct proof that Clark and the decedent were fighting that day. In fact, there was some testimony that they appeared to be friendly and normal. No direct proof that Clark had a mobile device on his person, and the mobile data provided by the carrier was consistent with it being in an area of several square miles. No direct proof that the car went right to the crime scene. There was ample opportunity for Clark to go a separate way. Likewise, the state can't even show whether or not a suspect was seen before Clark was already back at his residence. So the point is, this is a fairly weak set of proofs with much missing evidence. In that context, the improper admission of the Fifth Amendment evidence in the context of this case and the total lack of a limiting instruction was clearly capable of causing an unjust result. I would close by just reminding you of the cumulative error. So all three appellate division judges agreed that the court failed to instruct the jury on the state's separate burden to prove the perpetrator's identity by sufficient reliable evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Rakoff, we were here on the Fifth Amendment today. You're taking us back to the first oral.
I have like one more sentence, but even the state conceded that the court erred by failing to provide this instruction. It wasn't the defendant's burden to disprove that he was the perpetrator by offering the evidence. So this instruction, cumulatively, would have helped counter the prosecutor's burden shifting at summation. I'll leave it at that. For all those reasons, this court should affirm the appellate division's decision to remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Mingus.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I would like to begin by reiterating the circumstances surrounding the admission of this part of the statement and the prosecutor's summation, because this case is much more than the failure to object, but a choice not to object. Defendant never moved to suppress this part of the statement on grounds that he invoked his right to counsel. Instead, defendant only moved to suppress on the very limited ground that his Miranda waiver was not knowing. Then, after the trial court properly denied the suppression motion, defendant chose not to request a redaction of this part of the statement when he provided many other proposed redactions. And finally, he never objected to the jury hearing this portion of the statement when the redacted statement was played at trial. Instead, at trial, in case the jury did not hear the "call my lawyer" exchange, when the statement was played, defense counsel's last leading question on cross-examination highlighted the language defendant now takes issue with. Defendant explicitly used this part of the statement to his advantage to emphasize to the jury that despite him saying a number of times, charge me with this, call my lawyer, charge me, he did not confess and he was not charged that day with the murder. Then in summation, defendant again reminded the jury of the portion of the statement he now takes issue with, reminding the jury that had he that he had repeated to police, if they thought he had killed the victim, they should charge him right then on the spot. So defendant not only used this portion to advance his theory of the case, but chose not to request a curative instruction. Moreover, the prosecutor never commented on defendant's right to silence or right to counsel in summation. Instead, the summation, without objection, which we presume means defense counsel did not believe the remarks were prejudicial, was fair comment on a purported alibi that defendant himself presented. While it is certainly true that trial courts should endeavor to excise invocations from statements played before the jury, defendants are entitled to a fair trial, not a perfect one, evaluated under the circumstances as they unfold. On this record, there is no support for reversible error, and defendants, and we ask this court to reverse this decision of the appellate division and reinstate defendants' well-proved convictions.
Are you done with your opening statement?
Yes, I am.
Was it error for the jury to hear the defendant invoke his desire for counsel multiple times?
Well, I certainly agree that generally invocations should not come in. In this case, we have two situations. First, we know, on this record, it appeared that it was trial strategy for defendant to get this portion in. He was able to get his alibi.
Get trial strategy. Was it error? Does our law permit the state to present evidence that a defendant has invoked counsel and then come back at the defendant and attempt to get the defendant to confess after having invoked and do so in a pointed fashion as occurred here? Does the law permit that? Stay away from strategy.
No, generally no. Invocations should be excised from statements.
But that hedge word, generally. Was it error in this case?
Not to the extent of plain error. So every case that has addressed this issue with invocations being presented either through direct testimony of the interrogating officer or a prosecutor referring to an invocation in summation has analyzed the issue under the plain error standard. And in this case, to the extent that the trial court should have excised despite defense counsel's trial strategy and wanting this portion in, it doesn't rise to plain error in this case for a few reasons. First, the exchange was brief, and it ultimately ended the interview. And the context of the exchange in this case is very important. We do have the recording. We do know defendant's tone, and we know the words that he chose. And in this case, we know the detective at the very end of the statement, after he had asked the defendant where he was, who he was with, what he was doing, the detective says, it's game over, we've seen the videos, we've talked to witnesses, and defendant in response then says, if it's game over, charge me. His tone is defensive, it's confident. He said, repeats a few times, if it's game over, charge me, call my lawyer, plain and simple. So in this case, the harm is not there in the jury hearing this.
But what about the officer statements after? So defendant says, it's game over, call my attorney. It's not even ambiguous. He gives his attorney's name. Call my attorney, plain and simple, plain and simple. He doesn't say much after that but to, again, invoke his right to counsel, because the majority of the conversation is the officer saying, if I were you, I would be exonerating myself. We can run that down. We can run that down. We can run that down. So that's part of the harm, the jury hearing the officer inferring his guilt from his invocation of his right to counsel. Invocation of a right that he's told from the beginning, you have a right to an attorney, you have a right to stop this interview at any point. He does both. He stops the interview by invoking his right to counsel. The interview doesn't stop, and then it's used against him further in summation, where the prosecutor refers back to the officers begging him. Can you point me to where in the transcript the begging happens, if not after that invocation?
Well, the bulk of the interview really focused on what he was doing after 1:30, since that's the time he's unaccounted for. And so the jury did hear him say, he offered his own alibi saying, I was in Roebling, and then the jury heard the long gaps, the long pauses that defendant did not want to say who he was with.
They didn't hear much of that. A lot of that was removed from the video and the transcript.
That part was played.
There was some of it, but not, there's a couple of pages that was removed, and then it resumes with the officer saying, okay, you were in Roebling with someone and you took a walk.
I disagree, Your Honor. Looking at the transcript of the statement that was played, there is a significant portion where the jury did hear the pauses, the gaps, the defendant kind of suggesting that he didn't want to say, for whatever reason, what he was doing. So that was the jury did hear that.
Is that the port? Is a reasonable reading of the transcript and the video, that's a portion where the prosecutor's referring to the officers begging him because there were pauses?
So to the extent that the practically begging spoke to the part where defendant is saying, call my attorney, that was a fleeting comment. The majority of the prosecutor's summation focuses on pointing out discrepancies between the earlier part of the statement, well before defendant referenced an attorney at all. And it's definitely not so egregious to have deprived defendant of a fair trial. What we have is defendant offering an alibi, and we have the jury hearing the evasive answers, the vague responses, him not wanting to say. And so the prosecutor in summation is well within his right to point out the discrepancies. The jury heard that alibi. And the prosecutor is going through, I think it's a 36-page long summation, and a bulk of it is really focused on the discrepancies between where he said he was and what the evidence actually showed at trial.
So the jury got to hear the investigator call the defendant a liar, effectively, after the defendant asked for counsel. Forget about what happened with direct, forget about what happened with closing. Counsel says that's egregious. What's your take on it?
Well, first, again, and I would just point out that this wasn't objected to, that there was no request for this to be redacted, and I think that's very important in this case. Defendant had an opportunity, an explicit opportunity, to redact certain portions of the statement that he found to be inadmissible or prejudicial, and this was not one of them. And there were two opportunities. There was the first one of provide a list of proposed redactions, and then after the page numbers were a little bit off, so the prosecutor explicitly wrote out, here's everything that I agree with, is there anything else? And there was no request from the defense attorney to take out any part. And I think there's support in the record for why it wasn't taken out.
I actually want to follow up on the question, Chief. Plain error, tell me if I'm mistaken about this. I don't have the rule right in front of me. It's directed to the court. And the Chief Justice had used the term sufficiently egregious error. It is a directive to the court to take notice of egregious errors that is appearing before it, whether you're the trial court, the appellate division, or the Supreme Court. But let's say we're at the trial court level. And the Chief Justice earlier had mentioned, at the very least, the judge is listening to the tape. Our law specifically states that when you invoke the right to counsel, everything ends. Why, at that point, directed toward, now I'm speaking about the judge, why didn't the judge at that point recognize it is plain error to proceed, stop, and then at least ask, at the very least, counsel, you want this in? This is, our law says nothing else comes in at this point. Why wasn't that plain error straight at that point? Go ahead.
I think, again, going back, the tone of defendants, that defendant used his words in this case, he never incriminated himself before or after.
But his words were specific to invoking his right to counsel. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if he was angry, if he was crying, if he was upset. He said, call my attorney, call Mr. Keisler. He gave a name. So why, again, following up on the question Justice Alvin asked, why is this not error for the trial judge to have not stopped this at that point, knowing that our case law says after someone's invoked, everything after should be out?
This part of the statement underscored defendant's confidence in his innocence. And I think that's why the defense attorney wanted this part in. He's saying, call my lawyer, plain and simple. He's he's saying, if it's game over, if you know it's me, if I committed this murder, and that's part of the summation that defense counsel had.
Was there a conversation with the trial court and defense counsel where defense counsel made those representations?
No, but it's in the cross-examination. It's in that.
Which is in response
objection.
To direct examination. Didn't defense counsel originally want the statement out?
The entire statement, but after that motion was denied, again, there was no request for this part, despite an explicit opportunity for this part to be taken out.
And we really take from this record that it was strategy and not a mistake. And how do you get there?
I think there is. I think there's three parts. One, we know it wasn't requested despite other potentially prejudicial things.
Which could be either. That could be a mistake.
Be taken out. And then we have the cross-examination. The last leading question specifically refers to this part of the statement. Reminds the jury that he said, call my lawyer. That's specific, unlike direct examination where there's no specific direct question referencing defendant's invocation. So that comes out on cross-examination, and that's the last leading question. And in fact, the defense counsel then says, with this, I have no further questions. That's the last question before.
Think once it comes in, the defense attorney at least has to neutralize the damage that's being done to his client. So you're equating the defense attorney's trying to, stem the staunching of the bleeding here with the defendant purposely trying to cut this thing open. And there's a difference between the two, no?
There is, but in this case, it's not just an attempt to neutralize. It's an affirmative use of this part. After the cross-examination in the summation, again, there's a reminder of this part of the language that he now takes issue with, reminding the jury that he repeated to police, if they thought he had killed the victim, they should charge him right then on the spot. So this isn't just an attempt to neutralize a statement that's coming in. This is a choice not to redact this part because they're going to use it at trial.
Can you tell us whether this was invited error? And if so, how?
I think the three parts that I listed out, the email exchange, the use of this in cross-examination, highlighting this particular language, and then using it in summation was the affirmative use by defense counsel to use this part of the statement to his advantage. And again, the no objection to the prosecutor's summation, to the relevant sections of the prosecutor's summation, and then no request for a curative instruction. And we do have, unlike in Feaster and a few of the cases defendant cites, in many of those cases, defendant invokes his right to silence immediately, whereas in this case, defendant waived his right to silence and did speak with the officers for up to an hour. And in many parts, he did provide evasive answers. He didn't want to say who he was with, but he never invoked during those parts of the statement until the very end. And I would note that it also even in Feaster, there's a direct elicitation by the trial prosecutor to the invocation, and there's no context for that. Whereas here we have the statement being played, and the jury knows the exact exchange, the words used, the tone, the atmosphere shift. Even in all of those cases that are very different factually than what we had at this trial, ultimately the court undertook a plain error analysis. And it's our position that in this case, to the extent that the trial court should have excised this portion regardless of defense counsel strategy, defendant strategy, it certainly did not lead to an unjust result.
Do you at least concede that the prosecutor was able to exploit the questioning that occurred after the invocation of the right to remain silent? The police officers repeatedly stating, who is it? And then in summation, telling the jury, like, where is this person? He was asked to give the person up. Where is he? And that in part shifts the burden to the defendant, who has no obligation to present any evidence. Go ahead.
Two responses, Your Honor. Again, we do have a the majority of the statement being focused on what's happening after 1:30. So we know that even had this section been excised, the prosecutor could still have certainly addressed the discrepancies between what defendant said and what the evidence actually showed. And similar to Feaster, the jury was instructed here that it's the state's burden to show, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that it was defendant, and that that burden never shifts to defendant. And this court in Feaster recognized that while that's not directly on point with the jury hearing an invocation, a limiting instruction specific to that, it certainly does help the jury, like remind the jury that the burden is never on defendant, and it remains with the state.
Going back to invited error for a moment, Mr. Rakoff was not aware of any indication to the judge that the parties had settled on what was to be played for the jury. You have the same understanding?
Yes. So there's nothing in the record explicitly saying that both parties agreed, but we do know that there's no motion, that there was no request for redaction on the record, and that there's no objection to the statement having been played.
Yes, but your invited argument would be stronger if defense counsel had said, look, Judge, we've lost our motion. We want everything here to go in. There's none of that to be found here. Is that fair?
Not on the record, not that I'm aware of.
Anything?
I just have one. Is there anything in the record to indicate that the judge reviewed the statement before the trial, either because it was played at a 104 hearing or he was given the statement and read it in its entirety? Anything in the record?
Yes, it was definitely provided in the motion to suppress. But again, that was focused on the Miranda waiver.
I understand.
And just briefly, in response to defendant's argument.
You're not suggesting that because a 54-page exhibit was given to the judge had the obligation to go through it in its entirety, including parts that the parties didn't argue?
No, absolutely not.
Did the parties argue the last few pages?
No, absolutely not. It was just focused on the waiver of his Miranda rights as not being knowing.
So Mr. Rakoff accepted the suggestion that the strongest argument is the judge should have stepped in at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that?
At the
moment of trial.
At the moment of trial. Again, I would note that to the extent that the trial could first, we have no objection. We have defense counsel using that part of the statement in cross-examination, the very last question.
This has now been presented to the jury. The judge hears the defendant invoke not once, not twice, but several times, and then continue to be questioned and challenged by counsel, by the detective. What should the judge have done at that point?
Well, again, I think, again, reiterating this earlier argument, I think the context matters. I think the fact that defendant never incriminated himself, he maintained his innocence, and he underscored his innocence by the words that he used, really calling the detective on his bluff, saying, well, if it's game over, if you know it's me, charge me. And that's, so in and of itself, the way this part of the statement played out is not inherently prejudicial. It's not, he underscores his confidence in his innocence. He's not charged that day. The jury learns that he was not charged that day.
Do you think that the judge, I'm not going to take away from the rest of your argument, should have stopped after he heard the third time? Those are like fireballs going off in the mind of a jurist. And the defendant is invoking three times, and found out whether or not counsel wanted to proceed with the remainder of that interrogation going in? Should he have had an obligation under, and this goes to the whole plain error, meaning whether or not the trial court should be taking notice of what's happening before him or her? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I mean, again, we know that there's no motion to suppress that part of the statement, that defense counsel didn't file to suppress the motion because he invoked his rights. And so we have the statement being played in trial as the circumstances are unfolding, and then we have ultimately defense counsel using that on cross-examination.
The nature of all plain error is that there's no objection. That reasoning would say that A judge would never intervene. There must be some good reason for this.
But I think
and yet we have this rule. Go ahead.
Yes, I know, I understand. And then to the extent that the judge should have excised regardless of what defendant wanted, again, it's not automatically reversible error, and it's our position that it didn't lead to an unjust result. But I think it's important to look at the context of this. If this was so prejudicial and so harmful to defendant, why wouldn't his attorney move to suppress this part of the statement or highlight this part of the statement or to redact it? And none of that happened in this case. And I think that really highlights and underscores that it's the words used, how it played out, it wasn't harmful. It's not prejudicial, considering the context, the tone, what the jury heard in the statement.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. I would just ask this court to reverse the judgment of the appellate division and reinstate defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rocco?
Very brief. So, first of all, my adversary kept saying that, you know, this is fleeting or isolated or brief. This isn't fleeting. So, like, just look at a contrast of what happened in Feaster, where the court did call this fleeting. So, in Feaster, what happened was an officer gets on the stand and says, you know, I Mirandized him, and he invoked his rights, and that ended the statement. And that's it. That's what fleeting means. Here, we've got on video three times the defendant is invoking his rights. All the inferences from the officer insinuating that having just invoked, this is quote bullshit, that if I were in your shoes or if I were in your seat, I wouldn't be responding in that way, showing guilt. The prosecutor's comments on this, the fact that it was repeated again in deliberations, and the fact that the jury had transcripts in front of them as they were watching the video. All that in combination combined to make this very unlike Feaster in the sense that it's not fleeting, it's not brief, it's not isolated. This was from start to finish a part of the state's case. I would also point out, just in terms of it being reversible under the plain error standard, the cases Tilghman, Tung, Oliveira, all reversed on plain error, even in cases where the prosecutor says nothing in summation. So, you know, in Tung, it was a centerpiece of the state's argument that the prosecutor said nothing in summation there, and therefore it's harmless. You know, and the appellate division disagreed that, you know, it can be clearly capable of an unjust result just from the prosecutor showing a video like this to the jury where the detective on video is making these types of insinuations. In Tung, it was very similar. It was things like, well, why are you asking for a lawyer? Similar to the comments here about, you know, this isn't what I would be doing if I were in your seat. So it can be plain error. Our state's precedents show that it can be plain error even when the prosecutor says nothing. Here, I would also point out that the insinuations, so my adversary made a distinction between like a case like this and a case where the defendant invokes immediately. Well, in a case where the defendant invokes immediately, none of the insinuations come in like they came in this case. You've got, you know, a rhetorical 1,000 words here. We know how jurors react to videos. As this court has explained, the power of a video of contemporaneously recorded events, you know, it can't be disputed. The prejudice of seeing this type of presentation, not just invocations from the defendant's mouth directly, but all the interrogator's responses to that, it's something that we didn't see in the past. And the change in the method of presentation has greatly increased the prejudice. Finally, I would just close by saying the prosecutor pointed to, like, the very general instruction on reasonable doubt and the right not to testify, those instructions aren't enough. They're not on point. An instruction on the right not to testify is just inadequate to deal with the harm that was caused here. This was an additional harm. It's not just the defendant not testifying at trial. He made statements that were admitted into evidence as evidence of guilt that cannot constitutionally be used as evidence of guilt. The court has a gatekeeping duty, regardless of admissibility, to instruct the jury that these statements could not be treated as evidence of guilt, especially after the prosecutor is making statements in summation like ask yourself why. For all those reasons, I would request that you affirm the judgment of the appellate division remanding for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.